The Violins of Hope are an exhibit of mostly violins, but violas, cellos, and basses too, restored by Amnon Weinstein. The violins all belonged to Jewish musicians before and during World War II. Weinstein made it his mission to find the instruments, restore them, and let people play them. There are over 100 instruments in the collection, but only 70 actually tour. And right now, the collection is in Pittsburgh until November 18th. Many organizations borrow the instruments for events, like concerts. And every event is different. And each time there's a concert, the violins become known to the players and audience members alike. The traveling exhibit fosters awareness, but it also gives us a chance to hear some really great music, too, by Jewish composers. Welcome back to A Cellarondo. I'm Paula Tuttle, and this week I'm talking to Aaron Zelkowitz, a cellist and a lifelong advocate of Jewish music. Aaron founded and directed the Jewish Music Festival here in Pittsburgh for 14 seasons. He's produced a series of recordings titled Russian Jewish Classics. And he divides his time between Boston, Rhode Island, and Pittsburgh as a cellist. Also on the program, Glenn Lewis, the head of music at the Pittsburgh Opera, as he and his colleagues prepare a Violins of Hope concert featuring the resident artists and the orchestra concertmaster Charles Stegman. We'll get a taste of what it's like to hold and see and play these instruments from a few of the musicians that played them in the last weeks. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be with you.
I thought that your perspective would be interesting because you've thought about Jewish music more than most people as the director of your nonprofit, the Jewish Music Festival. I thought that you might have some thoughts.
Yes, I do have some thoughts. The festival, I founded in 2003, and our first series of concerts was in 2004, with three or four concerts a year, usually within a two-week time frame. And then around 2014, I packed up my car and moved to Boston. And I've done a few concerts since then, but on this just sort of a project basis. So when I knew that the Violins of Hope was coming to Pittsburgh, and I knew this was going to be a big deal, no one had any idea at the time that this would be on the five-year anniversary of these tragic events. Because of the overlap between Jewish music and Jewish culture and the fact that they were violins, that they are inherently a Western classical instrument and that they are best heard in that environment, I knew that I wanted to contribute something that would add to the overall exhibit, the Violins of Hope exhibit, and sort of push me to do something that I'd never done before.
Aaron, you played on a concert with the Edgewood Symphony for the Violins of Hope event this month. And did you get to play on one of the cellos from the collection, or did you get a chance to try one of the cellos?
I knew that there would be a cello. There's only one cello of hope, I guess you could call it, in addition to the Violins of Hope, but I did not even see it or play it. Yes, I played a cello concerto with the Edgewood Symphony that's based on Jewish themes, Lucas Richman's three pieces for cello and orchestra. And I also organized my own concert as part of the Jewish Music Festival's offering. And that concert took place less than a week prior. And for that program, as the violinists and violists of the Edgewood Symphony did, we performed on several of the instruments. Some of the instruments are reserved for the actual exhibit that were on display at the Posner Center at Carnegie Mellon University for the 7 weeks of the exhibit from October through November. And then some of the instruments were reserved specifically for concerts and educational purposes. And those were made available to us 2 days before the concert. I think we brought them to the rehearsal. And even though I had the list of the different instruments and the significance, some of them were played by this musician, some of them were played in Israel Philharmonics, some of them were actually played by survivors of the concentration camps. They all had these fascinating stories, but with the limited time we had, I basically offered it to the players we had who were members of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, and they just took whatever instrument they were comfortable with, given our limited rehearsal time. We played the rehearsals on those instruments, and then we played the concerts on those instruments, and then I introduced those instruments to the audience and just shared the information that we had about those instruments, which were selected for musical reasons, sound reasons, I guess you could say, rather than the background.
You want something people are comfortable playing. Maybe the cello wasn't appropriate for a cello concerto or something like that. I'm assuming that might be the reason that the cello wasn't being offered.
Well, it might have been offered, but for the Edgewood Symphony concert, I was really just there in a soloist capacity. I think the fact that these other instruments were being introduced, being performed by members of the Edgewood Symphony, that was significant in and of itself. The music director, Walter Morales, was kind enough to consult with me about the program as he was selecting the pieces because he knew of my background in programming classical music concerts, chamber concerts, and orchestra programs that were explicitly inspired by Jewish sources. And he felt that that was important to include because quite often, honestly, many of these programs that are associated with the Holocaust or used for Holocaust remembrance programs don't necessarily have, you know, Jewish musical content to them. And the Holocaust was a specifically Jewish calamity that 6 million people died because they were Jewish.
Let's talk about the Pittsburgh Jewish Music Festival offering that you talked about for the Violins of Hope. How did you frame the concert for your audience members?
Our chamber orchestra concert, the Jewish Music Festival concert that I organized, was a string ensemble of 10 musicians. I explained that this was not just a somber reflection on the Holocaust, but also a celebration of these cross currents of the orchestras that Jews used to play in, the instruments that they performed on, and the melodies that were created on these instruments and were created under these harsh conditions. Some of these incredible classical compositions that came out of these melodies.
Did you ask the people in your chamber orchestra what their reaction was to play on those instruments?
I think some of these musicians had several opportunities to play on these instruments, actually. Our first violinist, Jennifer Orchard, is also a member of the Clarion Quartet. This quartet makes it their mission to champion music of subjugated composers, so many of these forbidden composers. And there was also a Pittsburgh Symphony 360 concert in Heinz Hall, where the musicians also got to play several of the Violins of Hope. But I think they were all very moved by the experience. And yeah, I wanted to involve them not just as, okay, here's the music, play on this concert like it was another gig. But we also did readings from the book, The Violins of Hope.
Right, this book is a companion to the exhibit.
This is a book by James Grimes, who's a professor at University of North Carolina in Charlotte. Each chapter delves into one specific instrument, and then it relates the story of the owner of that instrument and the larger context. In one case, it talks about these orchestras that actually existed in the concentration camps. One chapter is devoted to the founding of the Israel Philharmonic. It talks a good deal about Amnon Weinstein, who is the luthier who collected these instruments, and the fact that his ancestors, his parents, were Holocaust survivors, and that's really why he did it. So I took excerpts from the book, and I should say this program was actually curated by Professor Grimes. So it was his idea. He did readings from his book, and then he chose the music and interpolated readings from the book with music that was specifically connected to that particular excerpt. And what I did is I just sort of expanded upon that. If he had a piece that was done with violin and piano or a piano trio, I found a string orchestra arrangement of that piece. And then I also added a few works of my own that connected with some excerpts from the book that he actually didn't read from back when he did the program. So this was a little bit of a collaboration, but it really was his curated idea. And then I took those scripts and I distributed those to the musicians as well. So before even the first rehearsal, they really had an idea of not only the stories that were going to be told at the concert, but why each piece was chosen and how it related to the texts.
When you say works of your own, you mean you picked some works that were different from the ones that he picked? You kind of mixed them?
Yes. Well, I wanted to add some works that weren't just Yiddish songs. There was a lot of Yiddish songs in the program. There was a work called Three Warsaw Polonaises by a Polish composer who was interned in a camp, and he actually wrote this arrangement in the camp and had it performed there, which is just incredibly powerful in and of itself. But they rehearsed this music in secret, and you just found these scraps of paper in the camp, and we performed it as a string trio. And it really sounds like Mozart. You might not even be able to detect that they were polonaises. But that's one example of a piece that really needed to be talked about and explained to the audience of why it was significant, because if you just heard it, it might just sound like any other piece of classical music.
Sounds like you have a program that's really focused on the Holocaust music, but did you round out the program with any substantial works by Jewish composers?
So I chose to do the Bloch Prayer, which is, as you know, a piece for cello and piano. It's occasionally done by viola or violin, and it's really done quite often. It's very popular as a piece that is sort of considered an anthem, I think, in a lot of these Holocaust memorial programs, because it is just so directly communicative and it really speaks to the Jewish soul, and it is a prayer, and it was appropriate for us to perform it in a synagogue. And then I was able to do it in the arrangement for cello and string orchestra, which is just so gorgeous, and I just had to do it. And then also the scherzo from Midsummer Night's Dream by Mendelssohn, because this was a piece that was chosen by the conductor Arturo Toscanini when he gave the very first debut performance with the Israel Philharmonic in 1936. He chose very carefully German works by Schubert and Brahms to show that this was an orchestra of Jews who, even though they were exiled from Germany and Eastern Europe, that they were just as gifted and capable of performing German high art as anyone else. And then the Mendelssohn was prohibited by the Nazis. Nazis weren't allowed to perform Mendelssohn. He was considered one of these banned composers, even though Mendelssohn himself was baptized, but he was considered Jewish by the Nazis.
And, that's right. He was Bartholdy.
His father was assimilated and baptized his children, but Mendelssohn's grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, was a great Jewish philosopher. And it can be argued to what extent Mendelssohn, despite his Protestant culture, still felt a kinship with Judaism, and you can hear it in his music or not. That's a whole other debate.
I think you hear it in that C minor piano trio. C minor, and then at the end you have the hymn, almost as if he's talking about his change.
Right. You know? And then the third movement of the cello sonata, same thing. It oscillates between the cantorial and then the church-like hymn feeling. So was my first chance to do an arrangement, which was a lot of fun. So I arranged the Mendelssohn, which, as you know, is for playing in all those ballets. It's an orchestral work, and I arranged it for string orchestra.
So do you think that these violins, are they instruments of change?
I mean, it's one thing to tell a story from history, from the Holocaust, which is coming up on 100 years. Soon enough, it'll be a century ago. It's another thing to actually hear a violin making music, a violin that was used, you know, by victims or survivors way back then, because it just makes it so, it brings it so immediately to us. And And if the music selected is appropriate and powerful, I think it can really be a moving experience for the listener. You know, I had the chance to visit Auschwitz my senior year in high school, and I got to see what they did in terms of turning those barracks into museums. There's only so much that words and reading books can do to make the thing come alive for you. But seeing, for example, those thousands and thousands of shoes, it's an emotional experience, and it hits you in a place that it's like music. You can't process it on an intellectual level.
Did any of the stories of any particular violins make an impression on you?
Well, there's the one story of Eric Weininger. He was a butcher and an amateur violinist, and he was arrested and taken to Dachau. And he actually was able to transfer out of Dachau. His sister-in-law arranged for his release. She was a British Quaker. And then it took him a year to get to Palestine, where he was, after all that, after going through hell, he was arrested as an illegal immigrant. And he was imprisoned in the British colony of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. So he and 1,600 other Jewish refugees spent the next 4.5 years in a prison. And this was after being released from a actual honest-to-God concentration camp in Germany. So I just can't imagine the harrowing,
story. Yeah.
And he had his violin with him the whole time, and he performed in a jazz orchestra there in that prison. They called themselves the Beau Bassin Boys, and they played satirical poems and songs and folk dances, and there's a photograph of them, which we published in the program. Just one of many incredible stories.
Well, this is great, and I thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
All right. So I'm here with Glenn Lewis at the Pittsburgh Opera. Welcome to the podcast.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So Glenn, as you work on the music for the upcoming concert, do you think more about the Holocaust?
One of the important things about it is the last generations of people who actually lived through the time period, like I think of my father, he'll be 89 years old, and he was 7 years old when the United States entered the war, want to make sure that an event as cataclysmic as that doesn't just become history. You know, that when there are no people left who lived through it. It's like when I lived in Germany for several years. During one summer break, I had the opportunity to go to Poland, and I visited Auschwitz and the Birkenau camps. Because I think if you ever have an opportunity to do something like that, you should.
What memory sticks in your mind?
In the case of Birkenau, it was the sheer size of it. To actually walk around the perimeter. And then in the Auschwitz camp, which is considerably smaller, the buildings are brick and covered with ivy now. And there's a strange sort of peacefulness that goes over it. And you go into each building, and in each building there's remembrances and things about the different groups of people that were persecuted during the Nazi regime. And there's remembrances of that. And seeing display cases that have 40,000 pairs of shoes that were left, and eyeglasses and suitcases. Things like that that you saw, that you would see. But also knowing that at the end of the day, you will go back to Krakow and you'll have dinner and you'll go on with your life, but remembering so many people that didn't.
Do you feel a responsibility attached to this concert because we have to make sure that we keep these stories alive?
As musicians, we have a role to play, and by bringing this music and recordings and concerts, that's our contribution to keeping the history alive. It's important for our younger singers, again, who are, you know, if you're born in 1996 or something like that, World War II is 50 years, you know, before you were even born. And to realize how much wonderful music was actually banned or suppressed, and to bring all of that back to light. Yeah, I think it's an exciting thing to do, actually, because part of what happens is you discover wonderful, really good music, not music that is just sort of a passing historical interest. You find this music is just as good as anything else. And when you hear the Zemlinsky Turmwächterlied that we're going to do on the program, you realize, yeah, this is as good as anything Schumann or Brahms or Schubert wrote. One of the other things is in this program is that we have to remember that before these composers were persecuted or banned or whatever, they were active in the 19-teens and 20s, writing, you know, music with wit and satire and social commentary. And so when we were trying to present this program, is not simply to be a dark hour of the horrors of it, but to actually show what did these people do after, you know, some of them came to America, or they came to other countries in Europe, or Japan, or Mexico, or what. They had thrived, or we've discovered the music that was lost for a time.
Looking through the eyes of some of these young artists that you work with, mm-hmm. are you surprised at their reactions? Are you getting some new insights?
What's great about it is that they have a great curiosity about it all. This isn't music that they are exposed to in grad school. Most of them were not exposed to music like this in grad school. This is not art that lives in an ivory tower, so to speak. This is art that is politically tinged, was affected by history, touched by the times that it was written in.
That's right. It's really rich with not just history, but a lot of emotion and a lot of turmoil.
And for them to wrestle with music like that. And of course, because we're singing, you're talking about words, you're talking about text, poetry, which has a very specific expression to it.
Anything more about the reaction of the singers?
Particularly like case of our tenor, Fran Daniel, he's looking for specific repertoire, and the Harlequin aria from Kaiser von Atlantis, the Ullmann piece, I think he's going to put it into his audition package as one of the pieces he will offer.
Right, they're expanding their repertoire.
Yes.
There's some keepers in here.
There are, absolutely. Part of what has to happen for pieces, you know, these operas to come to light is there has to be a pool of performers who know the roles. And that's something that takes a long time. It's like the Czech repertoire, which we didn't do until now. We have a pool of singers now that will do Janáček, will do Rusalka of Dvořák. They can help by exploring this repertoire. Second to last piece on the program is a big Zemlinsky song. Lead. Mm-hmm. Who knows, maybe these people who had these violins might have played performances of these pieces in the 20s or 30s, and who knows? All of this history is interlinked like this, and part of what we're going to show is people like Weill and Korngold went on to great careers, but sadly Ullmann and Ilse Weber died in the concentration camps.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I've been talking to some different violinists that got to play on the violins, and I want to share with you what Tina Fagan said. She's got a family of musicians. Violin runs really strong in their family. I know Tina mostly as a pianist, but of course she's a violinist too. Everyone in her family plays the violin. Here's what Tina said.
I feel so fortunate to have had the opportunity to play on one of the violins from the collection, and not just once. I got to experience it in three different types of settings. As a section member sitting within a full orchestra, and as a chamber musician and a small ensemble, I think what was most personally meaningful was playing as a soloist. I was standing alone, playing unaccompanied, listening to the particular sound of this violin's voice. I was playing the Maurice Ravel's Kaddish for unaccompanied violin. And it's such a poignant work. I think of it as almost a bearing of the soul. It's full of beauty and tears and hope. Ravel was inspired by the Jewish mourner's Kaddish, which is traditionally recited or intoned by a rabbi or a cantor at a funeral. And to play this particular work on this particular violin was truly a tremendous honor, an opportunity I felt compelled to accept, both for the sake of this violin story and for the sake of my own family's story. I used to ask my dad about his parents, their families, and how did they know what was happening to their relatives? And my father used to respond saying, well, the letters stopped coming so often, and they eventually didn't come at all, so we knew not to expect anymore. That's how we knew. As I practiced the Kaddish, it gave me a chance to feel connected to that extended family that he never met and I never met, and to remember them and pay them with my respects, to mourn them myself in private. And I felt a great connection there. There was a sort of a transformation within myself due to this that I'll always be grateful for. I didn't see that coming. I didn't even realize I needed it, and I'm very grateful. The violin itself, from the collection that I used for the performances, has a story. And when I finally met that instrument in person, I had a chance to pay my respects to all who had witnessed its voice through history. I was becoming in touch with where that instrument had been, who had heard it, who had touched it, and adding to its history moving forward. The man who owned the violin, Alfred Bernheim, had a small general store in Germany, and he and his family built it into a thriving shopping plaza and expanded it. It was like four stories and even had the first telephone and the first elevator in town. So these people were very active in their community, really involved using the schools and, you know, the same wonderful way most people are involved with their hometown. And then it was all taken away. Their town was one of the first Nazi strongholds. And the miracle is that despite being removed from their home and separated and sent to concentration camps and jails, this family did survive and they did reunite later in Israel. But what really struck me to the core about this particular violin story is learning that Alfred Bernheim and his family lived across the street from the Hitler family. If that isn't sobering enough, also Eichmann. The Bernheims, the Hitler family, and Eichmann were all neighbors. It's just such a sobering fact. It really just makes one think about how you respect and work with all of your own community. So to have the opportunity to talk about this violin story with my students, my friends, and audience members, it's just been way more meaningful than I had ever expected. And to let this violin's voice cry out, really, via the Kaddish in particular, it's just been an amazing privilege. So what I'm realizing now is the Violins of Hope project really changes the future lives as well as looks into the history.
Rachel Stegman had a couple of chances to play the Violins of Hope for the Wheeling Symphony and Pittsburgh Ballet Theater.
When you played in the Wheeling Symphony, you played on one of the Violins of Hope. Was there a story about it?
They didn't really know much about it, other than it was like, had a lot of the characteristics of some other Violins of Hope. The interesting part is like, the Nashville Symphony owns it, and so our new executive director is the previous executive of Nashville, so she borrowed it. And it was beautiful in looks. It has Star of David on the back and on the tailpiece. Beautiful violin. I was a little nervous about how it would play and playing the week's rehearsals and concert on it, but Sonia lent it to me for a few minutes and I tried it out and I was actually shocked at how great it played. The strings hadn't been changed for a few years, so that I did ask to change the strings so they could be fresh. So then it sounded great. I mean, I loved it. And you do feel like you become part of that violin story, which is like one of the big messages of Violins of Hope, is that the violins are telling a story and they will live on for such a long time, whereas a lot of the relatives of people of the Holocaust survivors, a lot of times it's my mother was there, my grandmother was there, and these violins will just continue to live on. So I do feel like I'm part of that violin story now. A lot of times people were asking me, well, how does it compare to your instrument? And the thing is, you don't really end up listening to it in that way because of just what it's been through and the story of that violin and the Violins of Hope in general. So listening through a different set of ears, you know, and you just really appreciate it and you like you feel the story and you look at it and just think, wow, yeah. Well, this is amazing.
You're saying, what is this violin?
Yes, and you're just loving it for what it is. And I felt honored to be able to play on a Violin of Hope because I've seen them go around the world and different colleagues in different countries even having that opportunity, and now it was our turn. So I felt thankful to be able to do that. I felt thankful to have more time than just right before the concert to just get to know the violin a little bit. And I really loved it. It sounded great. I was thinking I'd go back to my violin for the second half of the concert, but then I was like, you know what? No, they're here. This is really special. Right. So maybe I play my violin a little bit better, or it can offer something, but this night is not about that.
This was your time with Matt Violin.
Yeah, and that time's over now, so I'm thankful that that's what I chose. And now there's another violin I want to tell you about. So last week at the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater, there was a specially choreographed dance for the Violins of Hope, and so I got to play on a different Violin of Hope all week. They utilized one violinist as a soloist with the dance company. So I was actually part of the ballet. And the Violin of Hope that I use belonged to Joyce Vanderveen, who was a dancer. And so she was a musical, early on in life, musical genius. She conducted an orchestra at age 9. She went to the concentration camp with her family. They all survived it. And then she went on to become a prima ballerina and dance teacher. And she put that violin under her bed for many years and never told her son even that she played or anything about the violin. One day he discovered that violin, learned the history and the time period, and he donated it to the Violins of Hope. So Sandy Rosen, who is a mastermind of all these events, tremendous, you know, person, and organizer, she said, hey, why don't you use this violin for the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater piece? And what I did is I played a Jewish melody by Bloch, written for cello, but transcribed for violin. They choreographed a special piece for Violins of Hope by choreographer Jennifer Archibald. And so she came into town, and she has a very unique way of choreographing, which is really, you know, she doesn't think of it until she is in the situation, and she just kind of works with the dancers. But anyway, part of it was that she really wanted a Violin of Hope on stage with the dancers. And went through many revisions. I didn't end up being on stage in the end, but I was in the audience with the spotlight, and at a very poignant moment in the ballet, very touching, and at the very end, I played the Jewish Melody No. 3 by Bloch, which is a cello piece, on violin with a piano track that was actually very out of time because it's a very free piece, so that had its challenges. But to play it on the Violin of Hope while they were dancing, this whole commissioned piece was pretty amazing, and the audience just loved it.
And now you're part of the violin story.
Yes, I feel very much a part of that violin story, and using the violin in a world premiere ballet is pretty darn cool.
I also had the opportunity to talk to Charles Stegman about an instrument he's going to play on a concert this weekend.
It's a violin that was played by a former stand partner of mine, Shlomo Mintz, Juilliard. He was there, I think he was 18. He deferred his military training and was for one semester at Juilliard before he went and did his military service. I was shocked he had to do it, but he did. He's the last, I think he's the one who played it in Auschwitz. Shlomo's an Israeli boy, phenomenal violinist. One of the greatest violinists of all time. And so it was a trip to sit next to him. I just asked to see if I could get that violin to play here at the Opera Building, because he was, I think, the one who played that instrument in Auschwitz. So it's going to be a trip to actually play it. I'm curious to see what it sounds like.
You said he played it in Auschwitz. Where in Auschwitz?
No idea where. I haven't seen, I think there's a video of it, which I've not seen yet. I just found out about his participation with it. He played Baal Shem, which I'm going to play as well. And it's one of the great pieces of all time for violin and piano. So I'm looking forward to it.
You're going to play here at the Pittsburgh Opera next Saturday.
That's correct, at noon. Looking forward to it.
And finally, Juan Jaramillo gives us his thoughts on playing a Violin of Hope.
Hi, my name is Juan Jaramillo, principal second for the Wheeling Symphony and violinist for the Pittsburgh Opera and Pittsburgh Ballet Orchestras. I am very honored and happy that I was able to perform on one of the Violins of Hope during our last Masterworks concert in Wheeling. And there were two thoughts that went through my mind when I had the opportunity to hold these instruments and to play this instrument. The first was actually the quality of the instrument and the care that they had for the instruments. Sometimes when instruments are traveling around, they are a bit neglected, and the quality sometimes is not as great as you would expect. And I was very pleased that when I try at least 5 or 6 different violins, the quality of many of them, it was actually pretty high. And once I found the instrument that I wanted to play, I was able to use it for the very first half of the concert, and it felt very comfortable to play, and I only had literally like an hour before the concert to get adjusted to this instrument, and it actually felt pretty natural for me to play this violin that I had a chance to play. The second thing was that these instruments are actually actively being used all around the world and being used for different artists and different audiences. And that's what the makers intended to do from the very first time, to have these instruments be played and to make music with them. So it's very remarkable to me that the message of peace, the message of remembrance, and also the message of like community and togetherness is being transmitted through these instruments and music. And it is unbelievable that these instruments are not being kept in a safe and not being played. And just as a side note, one of the most expensive instruments in the world is a Stradivarius that, if you look at it, it is in pristine condition, like he made it yesterday. And it's kept in a safe, and it's barely played, and it sounds horrible because it's not being played. So these instruments need to be played. These instruments already bring a message just by their own creation. And on top of that, they're being actively used by artists and being brought to audiences all over the world. And that's the essence of the message right there. So I'm very honored that as a musician, music is still the center focus of bringing this message to all different audiences and generations. And I had a chance to be part of that history now.
Violins of Hope can be seen at the Posner Center at Carnegie Mellon University for 2 more weeks. Or you can check the website to see where they'll travel to. Thanks to everyone who helped tell this story here today and around the city for over a month. There are still events happening every day until the collection moves on. I'll post links in the show notes, but you can also go to violinsofhope.com for more information. Again, thanks to Aaron Zelkowitz, Glenn Lewis, Tina Fagan, Rachel and Charles Stegman, and Juan Jaramillo for your help on today's podcast. Don't hold back sharing this episode with friends and other people you think will enjoy it, and consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts and elsewhere. Violins of Hope has made a lot of musicians and audience members grateful for the experience, the insight, and the history they bring. I hope you get a chance to experience it in person. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time.